from GPB News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. The civil rights movement left a mark on many places in the South.
This movement didn't just happen in the cities. It happened all across the region. And you have to get out and see some of the sites out of off the main roads to experience that.
That is Georgia Tourism Director Kevin Langston. Today we'll consider what it means to market certain historical sites as tourist destinations. First, though, Friday the Break Room talked about the addictive powers of Facebook.
I was on my computer at work and saw that you have a Facebook page now.
Yeah, Dad, I was kind of forced to.
Well, so are you going to add me as a friend?
No, Dad, I really don't want to get more into it.
So I'm not your friend then?
Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, I'm Chase from Marietta. And I can no longer be on any kind of social media because as an anxious person, it increases my anxiety and doesn't increase my quality of life. So I just had to cut it out completely.
Hi, this is Audrey. I don't get it. I tried it. I don't like it.
Hi, my name is Ryan, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm 26 years old. I got rid of it in June, and I think it has made my emotional health so much better.
Wow, a lot of people hating on social media. Any supporters out there? We always love to hear what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. I won't mention our Twitter and Facebook page, but remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Many politicians have raised concerns about the new GOP tax bill. Some fear it will serve the rich and squeeze the middle class. In Georgia, there's concern about something else, our film industry. According to a study by the Actors Equity Union, the law will affect film industry workers in our state by hiking their yearly tax bill. With me to discuss this is Chris Joyner with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He writes the AJC Watchdog column. Good to have you back, Chris.
Good to be here, Celeste.
And also back, Craig Miller, film producer and founder of Craig Miller Productions. Hello again.
Hey, how you doing, Celeste?
Chris, does the tax bill affect film industry, either the workers or the industry itself?
It depends. It sort of depends on where people are in their earning on the film industry. I mean, the Tom Hanks of the world are probably not going to feel it, but people who are sort of more working class, blue collar, middle class earners could potentially find themselves with a higher tax bill because of how they earn.
Is the new tax bill taxing the workers more, those workers you mentioned, or the companies?
It would be the individual workers who are more at risk on their individual tax returns because of how they're paid.
So, Craig, how does this in the end up affecting whether or not a company decides to work in Georgia? How does it affect the bottom line of filmmaking?
Well, the nice thing about this is we're talking about a federal law. So it makes a level playing field across the entire
United States. People may have to pay more here, but they also have to pay more in
California. Exactly. I think that it's highly dependent on the particular facts and the circumstances of each individual and how they are set up to receive checks if they're an individual.
Explain that.
Okay, so on one hand, employees are losing what is called a non-reimbursed employee business expense. So if I'm an employee, I can no longer claim a non-reimbursed expense like my union dues or agent commissions against my W-2 income.
But agent commissions can be a lot.
They can be.
We're talking about, and my union dues, I'm a member, full disclosure, I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA because
that's the American Federation
of Television and Radio Artists. That's a lot.
Right. So there are two workarounds. This limitation does not apply to independent contractors or loan out companies. So if I'm paid as an independent contractor through Form 1099, I can still claim these expenses against my sole proprietorship Schedule C business income.
Okay, so if I have my own business, I'm a freelancer, so essentially I'm going to file as a business. Because I'm a business, I actually don't have to worry about a raise in taxes.
Exactly.
And Craig, that could drive people to just become freelancers? Sorry, Chris, that could drive people too many C names.
Yeah. C names.
Celeste, Craig, yeah, Chris. Could this possibly drive people to then make that choice to become freelancers?
Certainly, and they could incorporate. I mean, one of the things that I didn't know when I got into this column was how a lot of these actors and some of the professionals of the movie industry are paid. They're paid as regular straight employees. I thought everybody was a freelancer, but it turns out that when you're cast in a movie, you're hired on as an employee. You get a W-2 at the end of the year.
Correct.
So, when you have to come out of your paycheck to pay your commission to your agent, that has been in the past a deductible expense. Well, the flattening of the tax code in this new tax bill means that they're going to lose that deduction. So they're going to have to find some other way to get paid, either as a freelancer or they incorporate as an LLC or something like that, in a way to protect themselves. So it has a lot of people who are in that, solidly middle-class earning sphere sort of scrambling.
Well, let's hear about, this is kind of breaking down a little bit about the brackets you're talking about. This is CBS business analyst Joe Schlesinger explaining one of those brackets.
Essentially, if you make less than $24,000, you're not going to pay tax. So that seems really great. And when you claim the standard deduction, tax filing is far easier. Right now, about 70% of filers claim the standard deduction. Under this new plan, it looks like it's going to jump to 84%. So that's good. It's easier.
Except that if you're working any kind of real hours, you're making more than $24,000 a year. So, Craig, what is the discussion among people in the film industry about the effect this could have?
Well, in essence, let me say this first. In Georgia, we're on sort of a juggernaut of an entertainment ride in growing and producing movies. So we don't think this will slow down.
Worried.
We're not worried. Okay.
Okay.
The two best things to do, one is obviously we're already into the new year, but you want to form an LLC. You'd like to be an independent contractor versus being just a freelance person with a company that can then take care of these business
expenses. Or hiring
expense.
On every time as a regular employee.
Exactly. And if you operate through a loan-out company, the loan-out company can still claim all of these expenses as business expenses. Or if you incur them personally, you can still claim them as part of your Schedule E income.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking about taxes. Good morning. With Craig Miller, an Atlanta-based film producer, and Chris Joyner, columnist for the AJC. But here's the thing, Chris, is that when you talk about agent commissions, people who are not in the business may not realize that's sometimes 20% you owe to an agent. That's a big chunk of money. And if that becomes non-deductible, that's an issue for people who work in the industry. So how is this, with the people that you spoke to, how is this conversation going?
I think, a lot of them really are unsure of what it's going to mean in this coming tax year, in this current tax year. And I think that's caused a lot of unease. One of the reasons why I wanted to write this is because this industry has become a big part of our metro area workforce. That's creating a lot of people scrambling, trying to figure out how to best protect themselves. I think there's a lot of unknowns right now, and it's going to depend. For a lot of these people, their income fluctuates a lot year to year, so they don't really know how it's going to affect them year to year. So I do think a lot of people are going to form LLCs as a way to protect themselves. Whether that's going to be the right solution for them, you got to have a pretty sharp pencil.
Yeah, and then you also have a problem with health insurance and other things. And let me play this comment from Lee Onwuka. I think I'm pronouncing that. Patrice Lee Onwuka. She's with the Independent Women's Forum, which is a politically conservative group. She's here speaking on Fox News, and she's saying, yes, the tax bill will probably raise the cost of a lot of goods, which is what we're going to talk about next, but she doesn't think it will negatively impact the middle class.
We are looking at an economy that's strong and resilient. We're looking at low unemployment overall. So hopefully Americans would be able to absorb a little bit of a tax when they go to fill up at the pump. But, they're getting a bigger paycheck. They're getting better paying opportunities because of a market that's like on fire. And they're seeing their 401ks and their retirement growing. So maybe it'll balance out.
And that's kind of the question. When we start talking about paying higher taxes on goods, that's where this could actually impact the bottom line for production companies like yours. Right, Craig?
Sure. That's true.
You're still not worried?
Still not worried.
Chris, are other people worried?
It's
just the uncertainty.
It's really earning dependent. And, commentator on Fox that you just played, she's absolutely right. For a lot of middle-class earners, this is going to be a boon for them because they're not going to have large, unreimbursed expenses. And that's a really very...
Right, although that's short-term. I mean, it's only for the first few years that people will see their taxes go down. But then if you do the numbers, in a few years, taxes are going to go up.
Right, but you take somebody who's an actor or who's an electrician that works in the movie industry here locally, they're in just sort of a very specific sort of circumstance where they have an unusual percentage of unreimbursed expenses. And the tax code has been okay for them up until this point because they've been able to deduct those when they itemize. But, you know, those deductions are going away. Yeah.
And here's really the essential question, and I get that there's uncertainty about how this might affect, but if this drives a lot of people who were taking just regular jobs into forming LLCs, that's going to fundamentally change the labor structure of the film industry, will it not?
Most of the independent contractors that I work with are already formed an LLC. It's part of what we do in the business as technicians and as, you know, electricians and gaffers and grips and all of those kind of people. So it is a standard way of doing business for us already. There are people, again, it's independently determined on your own set of circumstances, will find out that they quickly need to do that and make that work. And also, you know, there's also the doubling of the personal exemption from as an individual 12K and as a mayor filing jointly to 24K, which will also, you know, help offset some of this not being able to file for your personal expenses.
Chris, let me take the same question to you, which is that we have seen since the Great Recession this what's called the gig economy, right? The freelance economy. It has been rocky, and it's a possibility this tax bill could increase the number of people who become so-called freelancers and independent LLCs, right?
I think that's right, yes.
Which possibly worsens our health insurance problem.
That could be. And, you know, and there's another question I'd be interested to know what Craig has to think about this, is, you know, it's going to require production companies to look at how they pay their employees. I mean, if they're used to paying them as straight employees, are they going to be flexible enough then to pivot and pay them as freelancers? And what's it going to mean for their bottom line in terms of their taxes? And Craig may know more about that.
Sure. You have about a minute left, Craig, if you want to answer that.
Well, all of the big movies are set up to work and pay people as employees.
Right.
It's the law. We have to do that. So the real benefit to the individual is to be an LLC that they can then be paid on that front.
If
they're allowed. And then also to work through loan out companies, which might work as well because then they'll offset the payment of these expenses because the loan out can take that deduction.
That is Craig Miller. He is a film producer, founder of Craig Miller Productions. We caught him as he was in the middle of a shoot today, so thank you
very much
for coming.
That's good. It was fun.
And we also heard from Chris Joyner. He writes the AJC Watchdog column. And at this point, Chris, more unknowns than knowns.
Yeah, I think this is really going to be a learning year for a lot of people in the entertainment industry here locally.
Thanks so much to both of you.
Hey, thank you, Celeste.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Georgia writer Anya Silver turns death into poetry. First, though, Atlanta's place on the trail of civil rights. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Southern tourism departments banded together this month to unveil the U.S. Civil Rights Trail. The trail links 110 historic sites from Kansas to Delaware. These are places where the struggle for African-American equality left its mark. Ironically, many of the states rallying behind this marketing effort are places where racial segregation was and is still entrenched. Joining me now is Maurice Hobson, a professor at Georgia State University. Always good to have you, Maurice.
It's always good to be here.
And Carl Barnes is a retired urban planner and advocate for African-American historical preservation. Welcome, Carl.
And good morning.
So, Carl, first tell me, give me the pitch for this civil rights trail. What makes it so significant?
Across the whole South, in particular, civil rights has been extremely important. I'm a proponent and a student of Brown versus Topeka. Almost everything that I have done in my academic and professional life, I am a student of what happened in 1954.
That would be the Topeka Board of Education.
Excuse me, the Topeka Board of Education. As I told some of my Georgia Tech alumni about a month ago, when I was born in 1950, my parents had no earthly idea that Brown versus Topeka was coming. So I am a beneficiary of all the things that happened in Brown versus Topeka, especially here in Atlanta.
And you were among one of the first black students to actually attend Georgia Tech, were you not?
One of the first African Americans to attend St. Pius X Catholic High School, and subsequently Georgia Tech. When I graduated in 1973, 600 students graduated that quarter, two African American families.
So, Maurice, one would look at this effort, and the website's beautiful, and think, well, nothing could be less controversial than the Civil Rights Trail, right? So why is this a subject of debate?
Well, it's a subject of debate because of the political tenor of the United States at this moment. The conversation around the Confederate monuments and the Civil Rights Trails is a polemic kind of battle. And so with this being said, oftentimes, this idea of civil rights memory is something that works to present a particular kind of curriculum to commemorate, but oftentimes it's a part of political, it's a part of tourism, the tourism of something. So it's part of the political economy.
You're saying that they're creating this curriculum to educate people, but it's cleaned up. It's sanitized.
It's extremely sanitized. And that's a part of the conversation around how we study civil rights. Oftentimes, if I say civil rights, someone would utter, Dr. King was the leader. And historians don't see it that way. We look at the on-the-ground leaders, the women of the movement that really pushed so much of what was going on. And so oftentimes, those narratives are left out. The working class is oftentimes left out as well.
Let me play this comment from Kevin Langston. He's the director of Georgia Tourism. He's speaking to Fox News here, and it sounds to me like what he's saying is that the one thing he hopes this trail will do will take some of the attention to civil rights history into the rural areas.
This movement didn't just happen in the cities. It happened all across the region, and you have to get out and see some of the sites off the main roads to experience that.
So, Carl, do you think this civil rights trail could actually bring attention to some of the lesser known places? People may not realize Midway, Georgia was an important location for civil rights.
Throughout my journey, yes, it will. I was part of the Department of Natural Resources, the Historic Preservation Division, the Georgia African American Historic Preservation Network, and that looked at all the resources, the African American resources across the state of Georgia. Also, as a part of that, I was with the Georgia Civil War Commission, and which was a statewide organization, and we created Civil War tours across the state of Georgia, Civil War trails. So when you start talking about getting the average citizen to understand why civil rights is important in the state of Georgia, these trails will show the average person in the community the history of the state of Georgia and the history of civil rights across Georgia, not just in Atlanta, which has already been known as a Mecca, but you get to Albany, you get to Southwest Georgia, you get to Southeast Georgia and Savannah. So you start to understand some of our lost historical figures and the trails and their journeys and what they have done to make particularly voting, housing, available to the African-American community across the great state of Georgia.
I wonder, though, Maurice, who you think that the audience will be. And I say this because of actually research that came out of, I'm going to say University of Georgia, but maybe it was Georgia State, where they found out that the people who are most supportive of displaying Confederate monuments, for example, in public places, also know very little about actual Civil War history.
Exactly. And that's a movement. I mean, if you take a population in the state of Georgia, if you take the population of Georgia State, many of the ancestors of, let's just say, white students who attend Georgia State, their ancestors probably were not even in the United States at the time. That's a conversation around immigration. And so as we move forward in terms of understanding public history, we have to look at things in terms of the archives and see. The problem with a lot of the conversation is that history oftentimes taught K through 12 is done so in terms of rote memory and quote unquote facts. But the way in which those facts are created should be done with primary sources and gaining, you know, the kind of empirics and metrics to to tell the story.
You historians and your primary sources.
Of course.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Maurice Hobson. He's the author of Black Mecca and a professor at Georgia State. And also with us is Carl Barnes, a planner and historical preservation expert. So, Carl, I was asking people about this at my local Waffle House, which ends up being this really great, diverse place in terms of political opinions. And one guy says, you know, this is great, this civil rights trail, because then we don't have to take the Civil War, the Confederate monuments down, right? We're putting up an equal number of monuments for African Americans. What's your response to that?
That comment is correct. You start to look at the Civil War and how important Atlanta and Georgia was to the effort. But one of the things when I was on the commission, I wanted folks to not look at the military aspect, but look at the socio-political aspect. Because when General Sherman came out of Nashville and Chattanooga, who helped him get to North Georgia? Who helped him to get to Atlanta? He had some maps, but those maps were not good. So you start to understand some of the bondsmen, former slaves, had to give him some direction. So the question that you look at, we have to educate our population on how General Sherman got to Atlanta. And then on top of that, how many folks know what Field Order 15 was, the 40 acres and a mule in Savannah? How black folks got all that land up and down the coast of Georgia and South Carolina. So it's extremely important. That I'm not sure that history's taught in our history classes of our public institutions.
I teach them.
At
the college level, but we do a lot of work with the Fulton County March. We do a lot of work with social studies teachers around the Atlanta metro area to really get them into the archives so that they can see that kind of documentation.
What do you make of my Waffle House guy's argument that this allows them to leave the Confederate monuments up?
Well, this is the thing. So the Confederate monuments, if you actually do the research and the metrics again with it, most of them were erected in the 19-teens.
Yeah, decades later.
And it was done so to assert this idea of white nationalism coming out of World War I. And then you also see recalcitrance that takes place in 1956 as states' rights thumbs its nose at the federal policy of Brown v. Board of Education. And so a lot of this Confederate memory that is public is actually contrived and is based on kind of a false narrative of what the war was and the lost cause and all those different things. What Mr. Barnes is asserting is that black people have been a part of this conversation the whole time. And this is a major kind of conversation. So the Civil War is a real conversation in terms of civil and human rights, because that it was fought over slavery, over the idea it grants citizenship and the right to vote, which is at the crux of understanding this conversation of democracy.
So when you look at the map, Maurice, of where they have plotted this civil rights trail,
yes.
do you feel like they've done a good job of sort of marking out the important sites?
I think that they've done a good job of those that are known, but we are just scratching the surface. Mm-hmm. And as we move forward, we're going to find new sites. We're going to find underground railroad sites that have been demolished and histories that have been lost. And that's going to be the exciting thing about it. I mean, when the archaeologists go in and begin to excavate and understand, that's where things are. So there are new things that will be discovered in this process.
And Carl, were there a lot of sites that you ended up sort of not choosing but would have liked to include?
Well, you know, when you start talking about sites, the civil rights sites will also uncover Julius Rosenwald and the Rosenwald Schools, where...
Now, many people don't know what the Rosenwald Schools were, so explain why those schools were founded. Many of them don't even exist anymore.
That is correct. Julius Rosenwald was the former president of Sears and Roebuck out of Chicago. Mm-hmm. He put together a fund that would allow African Americans, where there were not public schools across the South, to create public institutions and public schools. So you look at Georgia, for example, 240-some Rosenwald schools. A couple of them are still in existence, not as schools, but as community centers and things like that. So it's extremely important to, that's how you educate your community about what is important to them and why those, particularly the Rosenwald schools and those sites and all of the Rosenwald alumni, we're starting to lose those because they're in the 80s and 90 years old. But that's the whole legacy. If you look at African Americans in public education across Georgia, it is only relatively new, 50, 60, 70 years, where African Americans have received public education. a lot of people don't understand across Georgia, there was no 12th grade for African Americans.
That's right.
So if you don't have a 12th grade, yes, that's how people graduate from school at 15 and 16. So there was not a 12th grade. So you have to understand there's a legacy that we're perpetuating in public education on why it's so important. There was no public education prior to Reconstruction.
Right.
And I should mention a little fact from somewhere in my brain. Julius Rosenwald, son of German immigrants, he actually was born and raised just a couple blocks from Abraham Lincoln's home in Illinois, which so when you're talking about legacy, there is a history that just kind of passes on and on and on.
Right.
So, Maurice, when we talk about – when we discuss sort of the debate over the Civil Rights Trail, for me, sometimes I question when we put up these monuments and at the same time we have – present-day struggles, right?
Right.
It's this odd dichotomy where we're honoring this past from the 1950s and mostly 1950s and 60s, but at the same time, in present day, here we are still fighting the same battles that we're memorializing.
And the idea is that the monuments and different commemorations of this is that there was a victory, and we still struggle with that. And that speaks to a conversation that we have as historians called the long movement, the civil rights historiography. Many assume that the civil rights movement started in 1954, Brown v. Board of Education, and ended in 1965 with the Voting Rights Act, or 1968 with the assassination of King. But the truth of the matter is that it started when the first Africans came to the shores of Virginia.
Which predates the settlers landing on Plymouth Rock.
Exactly. And we still struggle with issues today. And so this is a conversation that we call the Long Civil Rights Movement. And it restructures the periods of how we understand this. It restructures who the major players are. And so that's where we are. I mean, the thing is oftentimes the public, the mainstream, is interested in, you know, assuaging some aspects of guilt as to how the state has participated in particular things. And then you have struggle that's going on the ground. So one is theory and one is practice, and it doesn't always line up.
Carl, what do you make of that? The fact that there are many people who see the civil rights as a battle that was fought and won.
We have a couple of generations of young folks, and I don't want to pinpoint millennials, that have no earthly idea of their civic duty or their civic history. And so when you start to ask the question, and that's why when I received this award at Georgia Tech, I made sure that they were aware when I was born in 1950. You think my parents were familiar with Brown versus Topeka was coming in 4 years? No. So when I got to St. Pius, they had no earthly idea.
St. Pius High School, which is in
North Atlanta. They had no earthly idea that I'm coming out of a traditional African-American Catholic high school over in Northwest Atlanta. Why we were there, what was happening. And their understanding of Brown versus Topeka was different than my understanding. We had different views, different experiences in life. So the whole context of this heritage tourism trail, civil rights trail, will give people a new lens to look at how the South has progressed. Or has it progressed? Yes, African Americans tend to rely on federal participation. Non-African Americans, in most cases, your majority population tends to rely on local or the statewide progression. But we got to educate everyone, particularly as we go into this 21st century and you start dealing with issues such as immigration, the women's appeal, the women's, all of those issues are issues that, you know, you almost ask the question, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, and the 19th Amendment that allowed women to vote. We're still dealing with those issues.
So, Maurice, in the minute and a half that we have left, the Civil Rights Trail is largely a tourist effort.
Exactly.
So what are we to make of this commercialization of civil rights history?
Well, we have to be careful that we don't sanitize. And as Mr. Barnes said, there are several other conversations around civil and human rights that it's not just about race. We have conversations around, you know, equal pay for women. We have conversations around the LGBTQ community and inclusiveness. So there is a larger conversation that is a part of this new movement. And basically what it is there is a mechanism amongst us that oppresses, and it manifests differently based on who it is oppressing and marginalizing. And so what we must do is we must produce conversations that come from the ground up. There are a lot of spiritual contexts that state that the greatest amongst you shall be the least. And so when we understand what those that are most oppressed are dealing with, then we can understand how to change it from the top in terms of policy and some different things. So the civil rights trail is nice, but we have to make sure that it's not sanitized. Mm-hmm.
That is Maurice Hobson, a professor at Georgia State and most recently the author of Black Mecca. Also, we spoke with Carl Barnes. He's a former urban planner and current advocate for historical preservation. Carl and Maurice, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the world is a little more beautiful through the eyes of Macon poet Anya Silver. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Not all poetry is about love and happiness. Writer and Mercer English professor Anya Silver often writes about depression, fear, and living with cancer. But her latest collection, Second Bloom, is also about life and joy. Silver earned the title of Georgia Author of the Year for Poetry in 2015 and is currently author of 4 poetry collections. Poet and English professor Anya Silver joins me now from our Macon studios. Hi, Anya.
Hi, Celeste. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have you back. And I was interested from the very beginning, you chose to start the book with a quote from the Bible. Mm-hmm. And it says, "Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of countenance the heart is made glad." And I wonder, why did you start with a quote that says sorrow is better than laughing?
Well, a couple of reasons. I think that when people go through sorrow or trauma of some sort, they grow in a way that they might not if their lives were completely happy. And it's possible to gain wisdom from that. But also that if you experience sorrow, you truly understand the moments of joy and happiness in a new and more vibrant way. So that quote in Ecclesiastes has always spoken to me for that reason.
One of your poems said that when you're sad, I don't remember the exact wording, but it was said when you're sad, you read the Psalms. Why?
Yes. I find the Psalms incredibly comforting. The celebratory Psalms remind me of the beauty of life, and that sort of ennobles my life. And the poems about suffering make me feel less alone, and I realize that I'm not the only person in the world going through something painful, and that there's a whole community of people who are going through difficult times, and that sense of community is really valuable to me. And just in general, the idea that there is a God to whom I can speak, whether it's in happiness or anger, is something that sustains me.
So, as always, your poetry is very honest and straightforward, and I was struck by the very first poem. You sort of lay it out, and there's a couple lines in there where you say, "I don't know why I'm still alive," which sort of hit me like a dagger. And you follow it with, "I don't know how a line of poetry sometimes loses itself and finds me." And I wondered, you're basically beginning your book of poetry by saying, "I'm not sure why poetry has power over me," in a way.
Right.
How come?
Well, it's always been a mystery to me how I write poetry, and I'm not saying this in any sort of self-aggrandizing way, but sometimes I feel like poetry comes from the outside, comes from something transcendent, and it's always a miracle to me when I think of a line of poetry, not knowing whether it's coming from just my neurons firing or whether there's some transcendent force, what God or the divine or the universe or whatever, working through me. And it's the same thing about life. I don't know why I'm alive and why my friends have died. There's no reason for that. It just is. And dealing with why that is, well, there's no answer for it. I have to deal with it. It's just what I cope with and think about every day.
Well, let's go back to this issue of the divine, because it comes up a lot in this new book of poetry. And I want to read a couple lines that struck me, because you, in many poems, you seem to be sort of having a conversation with the divine. And at the end of one, you say, "Merciful one, begotten of woman, understand how difficult it is to trust that you are kind."
Yeah, that's one of my anger poems. Well, you know, we're raised, I was raised in the Christian faith, and I'm still a Christian. And so we're raised with this idea of the ever-loving, omnipotent God. And that, to me, has always been really theologically a problem, because I don't, and of course it has been for so many people, because I don't know why a loving God would allow a young woman with children to die a horrible death. And so in that poem, I was thinking about a very good friend of mine who died, and she had two children. And it was Christmas, and we were thinking about the goodness of God and Christ. And I was thinking, well, what's the proof that God is good in the world? What's the proof that God loves us when we see people around us suffering? And I didn't really have an answer for that. So I was just telling God, well, sometimes I don't really trust you. I don't know what you're thinking. I guess I believe in a faith that has room for anger toward God and questioning of God. And I don't feel like that's incompatible with being a person of faith.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author, poet, and Mercer English professor Anya Silver. And then the second section of the book, I mean, you mentioned Christmas. The second section is centered around holidays, Christmas, New Year's, Lent, Easter. And it occurred, you know, I was thinking about it as I read these poems, that especially when you have kids, those holidays are really important. Like, those are the markers that create your memories of childhood, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly, right.
And that was my question. I said, I wonder if that's where this comes from. Like, these holidays become sort of the mile markers. These are the places that allow you to sort of count the passage of time.
Right. Well, in the Episcopal Church, we have long periods of time that are called ordinary time, but then we also have these periods of Lent and holidays. And I'm a very ritualistic person, and so I really organize my life around certain holidays and certain mile markers like birthdays or Christmas or Easter. And those are always the times that appear most strongly in my memory and that I try to live most consciously. And there are also the times when I talk to women who are sick that the women want to live for. They say, I want to make it to the next Christmas. I want to make it to the next Easter. There's just a way in which those holidays give us a sense of time in our lives when time is so amorphous. And it also makes those holidays difficult because it puts so much weight on them. We feel so much pressure for those days to be perfect and to survive us in memory.
I wonder if you would read a poem for me. I think it's from the third section. It's called Noah.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, the name, your son's name, I mean, since we're speaking about faith and speaking about the Bible, obviously your son's named after a very important man of faith from the Bible, which to me made the poem itself all that more poignant. Would you read it for us?
Do you mean the Psalm for Noah?
Yes, Psalm for Noah.
Yes, okay. Yes, this is Psalm 137 for Noah, and it's based on Psalm 137. Psalm 137 for Noah. Come, darling, sit by my side and weep. I have no lyre, no melodious voice or chant. I meditate on the Zion I could never grant you. My son, my roe deer, my rock rent stream, my honeysuckle, my salt, my golden spear. Forgive me your birth in this strange land. I wanted your infant caresses, your fists clasped around my neck. I craved you, though you were born in the wake of my illness, my dim prognosis. I was selfish. I willed you this woe, this world. You inherited exile for my sake.
So there are conflicting thoughts going on here, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
It sounds as though you feel in a way guilty that you brought this child into the world knowing that you may not be there to see all his future birthdays.
Yes. I was diagnosed originally with cancer in 2004 when I was pregnant, and my son is really the joy of my life. I mean, I feel so lucky to have him. But there is always this guilt, and I think all parents probably feel this to some degree when they see terrible things happening in the world. But there's always this sense of guilt for me that if something terrible happens to me, if I die young, that I will have brought him pain in bringing him life. And I question to myself whether it's right to bring a child into the world when you guarantee that child pain. But the thing is, that's the case for everybody. I mean, everybody who has children knows that their child is going to suffer, and we just have to, I guess, in my case, I decided that the joy of life and the beauty and connection of life were more important than the chances of suffering. But it's certainly something I think about a lot, and I do feel some guilt about it.
Do you talk with him about that?
No, not specifically.
But he's read the poem.
I don't know if he has. He probably will after this broadcast.
Because he's 14, 13?
He's 13, and we do talk about it. I haven't talked to him about this because I don't want him to sense that I have any regrets about his birth, which, of course, I don't. But being a parent just comes with so many conflicting emotions, and it's so intense and overwhelming. And sometimes we do have these feelings that we don't like to talk about. And I wanted to just be completely honest with the fact that I felt them, even though when I said to people sometimes, oh, it was wrong to have a child considering my health, they are shocked and upset that I would say that. But I think it's something that people feel, and I just wanted to be honest about it.
Well, you are incredibly honest, and your poetry always has been, as I mentioned, but I wanted to read another section from a poem because one of the things that struck me is how often it sounds like you're saying, I don't know how to make poetry out of what's happening to me,
right,
while you're making poetry out of what's happening to you.
Right.
So there's a part where you say, today when I could be writing, I sit waiting for a nurse to access me, that is, puncture me with a needle. I cannot work because of the talk, the cold room, the television's jabber, the microwave smells of grease and burn. I want words, but my mind stalls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you do that? I mean, you are addressing some, very, in some cases, prosaic. You curse a couple times in the poetry.
Yes, I do. I'm sorry. Well, one thing that I was, on the one hand, cancer has been this mine of amazing subject matter for me, just like, you know, my family has and my husband has been. But on the other hand, it takes so much time to be a patient. It takes so much time to be ill. Anatole Breuillard, who wrote for the New York Times, said that patients are the best people at waiting because we learn to just spend huge amounts of our time waiting. And so sometimes I do resent my illness and resent my body for getting in the way of me being able to write. So I resent the fact my body is too tired to write or that my mind is too tired. And sometimes I worry that that will keep poetry from it will keep me from writing poetry, and I just have to trust that poetry is this mother tongue that will come back to me despite the fact that my body sometimes feels like it's failing me, and I do feel a lot of hostility towards my body for preventing me from doing what I want to do.
What is the benefit in presenting these very uncomfortable images for people, presenting to them these very, in some cases, frustrating and in some cases upsetting images into poetry?
Well, I think that as a culture, we are very illness phobic. We don't talk about it a lot. We're very death phobic. And I want to resist that narrative and to be able to speak honestly about the difficulties of life, both for people who are experiencing it and might feel alone in their experiencing, and also for people who haven't experienced it so that they can understand what it's like to feel this pain and uncertainty. So I think that good writing has to be honest. And if it's not completely honest, then it's not living up to what it could do. And so there are poems that I write that I wouldn't publish, but for me, there should be nothing taboo in terms of writing about, because a writer's job is to bring the truth to the world, his or her truth. And if my truth is uncomfortable for people, then that isn't really my problem. My job is to bring my truth to the world, and my truth isn't always pretty.
And yet it's this, for me at least as a reader, it occupies an odd space, because it's mm-hmm. escapist for me, because the writing is beautiful, and it is the opposite of escapist.
Right.
Because it is extremely real. This is about death and mm-hmm. life and what you choose with these moments. And in one of the poems, you describe being at a meeting, a real meeting. Mm-hmm. In which you mentioned cancer and everyone kind of looks away. And the reason I know that it's real is because when I posted that poem on Facebook, somebody wrote, I was at that meeting.
Oh, goodness. Uh-oh. People are just so uncomfortable with illness. And the thing is, I'm not uncomfortable talking about it. I'm not uncomfortable joking about it. I'm not really uncomfortable with death. I think death is just a natural part of the human process. And there's a poem I have called Nocturne, in which I refer to withered petals alongside sumptuous ruffles. Well, you wouldn't have the sumptuous ruffles of joy and belonging and life if you didn't have those withered petals. But you can't have one without the other. And so I have a tremendous amount of joy in my life, and my joy coexists with pain. I don't see those two things as completely separate. I think all of life is woven together, and separating the strands is impossible. So I'm comfortable talking about those things and still being a happy person.
That is poet and Mercer University English professor Anya Silver. Her latest book of poetry is called Second Bloom. She'll give a reading tonight at the Decatur Public Library at 7:15. Anya, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Celeste. I really appreciate being here.
And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you. We talked about the Civil Rights Trail earlier. Would you travel to see the important places in civil rights history? Would that be a draw for you? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Twitter. We're at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.